online here from the Board of Trustees implement on proposed changes to the convention. Several members of the UVM Board of Trustees voiced their concern regarding the university's proposed changes to the commencement weekend during a presentation at the October 25th meeting. The proposed plan will move individual college ceremonies to Champlain Valley Expedition and do away with the main ceremony and commencement speaker, according to the October 14th Cynic article. So those two little articles from the Cynic, UVM's independent voice since 1883. That's our little tagline. Another student-run organization you could potentially join, check out, get involved with. I'm not part of it because non-community members can't be part of it, but here we have a good mix of community members who interact with the students. They bring a little bit to the station, and the community members bring a little bit to the station. It's one of the maybe get on my soapbox a little bit, but Robert Putman, who's probably one of the biggest advocates for social capital, talking about ideal group sizes and ideal communities that are being made. There's the Dunham number, which stands about 150, which is the how large you want the organization to be. That's about the maximum size. And use the most ideal ones of a large enough size for active community engagement, has a diversity of age ranges and people's ideas of from around the world. Usually, when you pointed out to which are the most effective organizations, some of those factors came into being connected to the community at large, have a diversity of age ranges, and the size of the organization. So moving on to the weather, if you can't tell, let me turn my mic a little bit. It is snowing outside, like snowflakes, big snowflakes. Just in case if you're locked in the basement and you can't see anything outside, that's what's going on in the weather. But in general, Monday, which is the 9th, it says the high is going to be 31, low 28. It says it's going to be snow, it's going to be 1.5 inch accumulation in this great Burlington area. Tomorrow it's going to be cloudy, low high of 37, a low 35. That's not much of a temperature range. And on Wednesday it's going to be a high of 44, low of 34, and rain will likely happen. Actually, 100% rain will happen, and you should get about 1.25 inches of rain, according to the forecast. And then it gets sunny again on Thursday. 36 degrees is the high, 20 is the low. So without further ado, we're going to play you a public service announcement. We'll get into the book called Social Wire, Where Brains Are Wired for Social Connections. Probably, I would say, of the 200 sources, 200 that I've kind of sorted through, it's a very, very in-depth book. Has a nice combination of some very solid foundation of brain science, and also bringing in some interesting stories of how that connects to the social world. So, public service announcement, you guys. And the number here is 656-4399. Give me a call.
Did you know that expressing yourself in creative ways can help to relieve stress and anxiety? It has also been shown to help lower levels of anger and depression after a traumatic event. People often shy away from any kind of artistic or creative expression because they don't consider themselves to be quote-unquote good, but you do not need to be good at something for it to matter or have value. If you enjoy it, do it regardless. The DJs at WRUV recognize the importance of expressing yourself creatively and encourage you to show yourself love through creation.
Choosing a president. First, 1984. President Ronald Reagan and his challenger, former Vice President Walter Mondale, held the second of two nationally televised presidential debates in the run-up to the presidential election. President Reagan remained popular, but his support was softening in light of growing concerns about his age. His poor performance in the previous debate 3 weeks earlier had opened the door to questions about his mental fitness. If reelected, Reagan would become the oldest sitting president in U.S. history. He was 73 at the time of the debate. Reagan's performance at this final debate is frequently cited as a turning point in the election, when Reagan's popular support solidified, contributing to the largest electoral landslide in history. How did Reagan demonstrate that he was still in command of all of his faculties? Did he display his erudition on the current issues of the day? Did he play to his own strengths by vigorously attacking Mondale on issues like foreign policy or the tax code? No. It was Reagan's comedic timing that allowed him to carry the day. Reagan delivered a series of prefabricated one-liners with aplomb, regained his momentum, and never looked back. The most notable zinger came when the moderator asked him if age was a concern in the election. Reagan famously replied, "I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience." Mondale, not exactly a spring chicken at 56, later commented that he knew at that very moment he had lost the campaign. That night, nearly 70 million Americans watched the debate and came away convinced that the Gipper still had his mojo. Any fears people had that President Reagan had slipped were assuaged. But how we as a nation reached this conclusion on that night is surprising. Reagan himself didn't change our minds about him. It took a few hundred people in the audience to change our minds. It was their laughter coming over the airwaves that moved the needle on how we viewed Reagan. Social psychologist Steve Fine asked people who had not seen the debate to watch a recording of it in one of two ways. Some individuals saw clips of the debate and the audience's reaction as it was played on live television, while others saw the debate without being able to hear the audience's reactions. In both cases, viewers heard the president deliver the same lines. Viewers who heard the audience laughter rated Reagan as having outperformed Mondale. However, those who did not hear the laughing responded quite differently. These viewers indicated a decisive victory for Vice President Mondale. In other words, we didn't think Reagan was funny because Reagan was funny. We thought Reagan was funny because a small group of strangers in the audience thought Reagan was funny. We were influenced by innocuous social cues. Imagine watching the debate yourself. Or maybe you did watch it. Would you think audience laughter could influence your evaluation of the candidates? Would you be influenced by those graphs that CNN shows at the bottom of the screen during today's debates to indicate how a handful of people are responding to the candidates moment by moment? Would it sway your vote? Most of us, I suspect, would say no. The notion that our decision about who should be the president of our nation could be altered by the responses of a few people in the audience violates our theory of human nature, our sense of who we are. We like to think of ourselves as independent-minded and immune to this sort of influence. Yet we would be wrong.
We can give a perfectly sound biological account of why there should be pain and pain behavior. What we want is a similarly anchored account of why there should be hilarity and laughter. I wrote that more than 20 years ago and more or less promised to provide that account in that book. When I thought about it good and hard and did some reading, I was as stumped as any Neanderthal could be. It was an embarrassment. I just gave up. And then along came Matthew Hurley. This is a perfect illustration of what Steve Miden was just telling you about the extended mind. Matthew is a student of mine who showed up, and he wanted to do a theory of humor. And I said, much too hard, much too hard. Do something else. No, he would not be dissuaded. And this resulted in the Hurley model of humor in the book that we published together just a year or so ago. The paperback's just out, Inside Jokes Using Humor to Reverse Engineer the Mind. This cartoon, in a way, was the inspiration for Matthew Hurley's model. He began to notice that in many languages, there's a word like funny in English, which has two meanings, nicely exemplified here. There's funny, uh-oh, what's that funny smell? What's that funny noise? And then there's funny, ha-ha. And it turns out that's true in a lot of languages. We've got a good dozen that there's a term like this. And he decided that was actually an important clue. And the clue really is that humor always begins with a bit of a mistake. It always begins with a tiny uh-oh, which is then resolved almost immediately into, oh, never mind, it's okay. And it's this down-up, starting off with a little bit of negativity, a little down, followed by a little bit of up. The same point's been made in a wonderful book by David Huron called Sweet Anticipation about music. Now, Huron's book is about reverse engineering the mind using music as a probe. Ours is about using humor as a probe. As he says, pleasure is increased when a positive response follows a negative response. While surprise is biologically bad, surprise nevertheless plays a pivotal role in human emotional experience. Surprise acts as an emotional amplifier. We call this the Huron trampoline. We sometimes intentionally use this amplifier to boost positive emotions. That's one of the keys to our model. Covert entry is very important in humor. The mental spaces filling up with all this furniture as life goes on easily cluttered up and they get easily contaminated. And what happens is that mistaken premises enter without notice. They enter covertly. And this is important to achieve the groundwork for making something funny. I'll give you an observation which just makes this point in spades. If there is a joke that in order to understand it, there is some fact you have to know, and you want to tell a joke to somebody who doesn't know that fact, and you tell them the fact first, then you tell them the joke, no humor at all. No humor at all, because the fact entered not by covert entry, but entered very publicly. If the facts that the joke depends on aren't common knowledge so that you don't have to mention them, so that they will automatically get generated in this helter-skelter mental space furnishing, you're not going to have humor. That's, of course, also the main reason why humor doesn't travel all that well, how it often depends on very small groups of people who happen to share the same basic tacit understanding.
Every day, others influence us in countless ways that we do not recognize or appreciate. If this is true, why would our brains be built to be unwittingly influenced by people we don't even know? Before judging the gullibility of our gray matter so harshly for using audience reactions to make sense of Reagan, let's take a moment to appreciate just how difficult it is to read other people's minds, to discern their character from the things they say and do. Thoughts, feelings, and personalities are invisible entities that can only be inferred, never seen. Assessing someone else's state of mind can be a Herculean undertaking. Was Reagan still Reagan? Or had his mental faculties diminished? How could we know the difference without extensive neurological examinations? We all engage in this kind of mind reading of others every day. And it is so challenging that evolution gave us dedicated neural circuitry to do it. While we tend to think it is our capacity for abstract reasoning that is responsible for Homo sapiens dominating the planet, there is increasing evidence that our dominance as a species may be attributable to our ability to think socially. The greatest ideas almost always require teamwork to bring them to fruition. Social reasoning is what allows us to build and maintain the social relationships and infrastructure needed for teams to thrive. That the brain has a network devoted to this kind of mind reading of others. The surprising thing is that even though social reasoning feels like other kinds of reasoning, the neural systems that handle social and non-social reasoning are quite distinct and literally operate at odds with each other much of the time. In many situations, the more you turn on the brain network for non-social reasoning, the more you turn off the brain network for social reasoning. This antagonism between social and non-social thinking is really important because the more someone is focused on a problem, the more that person might be likely to alienate others around him or her who could help solve the problem. Effective non-social problem solving may interfere with the neural circuitry that promotes effective thinking about the group's needs. The presence of a dedicated system for social reasoning in our brains still doesn't explain why most people watching the presidential debate were so affected by the responses of the audience. In this situation, the social reasoning system appears to have failed, resulting in distorted perceptions of the debate. Some part of our minds mistook anonymous audience laughter as a valid indicator of Reagan's mental vigor. Why would we substitute the judgment of others for our own? This was no momentary lapse. The world is filled with such laugh tracks and other contextual cues because our brains are designed to be influenced by others. Our brains are built to ensure that we will come to hold the beliefs and values of those around us. In Eastern cultures, it is generally accepted that only by being sensitive to what others are thinking and doing can we successfully harmonize with one another so that we may achieve more together than we can as individuals. We might think that our beliefs and values are core parts of our identity, part of what makes us us. But as I'll show, these beliefs and values are often smuggled into our minds without our realizing it. In my research, I have found that the neural basis for our personal beliefs overlaps significantly with one of the regions of the brain primarily responsible for allowing other people's beliefs to influence our own. The self is more of a superhighway for social influence than it is the impenetrable private fortress we believe it to be. Our socially malleable sense of self, which often leads us to help others more than ourselves, is the third major adaptation I'll be discussing. Social networks for social networks. Most accounts of human nature ignore our sociality altogether. Ask people what makes us special, and they will rattle off tried and true answers like language, reason, and opposable thumbs. Yet the history of human sociality can be traced back at least as far as the first mammals more than 250 million years ago, when dinosaurs first roamed the planet. Our sociality is woven into a series of bets that evolution has laid down again and again throughout mammalian history. These bets come in the form of adaptations that are selected because they promote survival and reproduction. These adaptations intensify the bonds we feel with those around us and increase our capacity to predict what is going on in the minds of others so that we can better coordinate and cooperate with them. The pain of social loss and the ways that an audience's laughter can influence us are no accidents. To the extent that we can characterize evolution as designing our modern brains, this is what our brains were wired for: reaching out to and interacting with others. These are design features, not flaws. These social adaptations are central to making us the most successful species on Earth. Yet these social adaptations also keep us a mystery to ourselves. We have a massive blind spot for our own social wiring. We have a theory of who we are, and this theory is wrong. Is to get clear about who we are as social creatures, and to reveal how a more accurate understanding of our social nature can improve our lives and our society. Because real insight into our social nature has gained momentum only in the last few decades, there are tremendous inefficiencies in how institutions and organizations operate. Societal institutions are founded, implicitly or explicitly, on a worldview of how humans function. These are theories regarding the gears and levers of our nature that institutions try to operate on in order to strengthen society. Long before there were any primates with a neocortex, Mammals split off from other vertebrates and evolve the capacity to feel social pains and pleasures, forever linking our well-being to our social connectedness. Infants embody this deep need to stay connected, but it is present through our entire lives. Mind reading. Primates have developed an unparalleled ability to understand the actions and thoughts of those around them, enhancing their ability to stay connected and interact strategically. In the toddler years, forms of social thinking develop that outstrip those seen in the adults of any other species. This capacity allows humans to create groups that can implement nearly any idea and to anticipate the needs and wants of those around us, keeping our groups moving smoothly. Harmonizing. The sense of self is one of the most recent evolutionary gifts we have received. Although the self may appear to be a mechanism for distinguishing us from others and perhaps accentuating our selfishness, the self actually operates as a powerful force for social cohesiveness. During the preteen and teenage years, adolescents focus on their selves and in the process become highly socialized by those around them. Whereas connection is about our desire to be social, harmonizing refers to the neural adaptations that allow group beliefs and values to influence our own. Inverting Maslow. In 1943, Abraham Maslow, a famous New England psychologist, published a paper in a prestigious journal describing a hierarchy of needs in humans. The hierarchy he identified is typically depicted as layers of a pyramid. Maslow suggested that we work our way up the pyramid of needs, satisfying the most basic needs first, and then, when those are satisfied, moving up to the next set of needs. At the bottom of the pyramid are physiological needs like food, water, and sleep. The next level of the pyramid focuses on our safety needs, such as physical shelter and bodily health. Physiological and safety needs are really fundamental needs with a capital N. No one can do without them. The rest of the pyramid consists of nice if you can get them needs or needs with a small N. My son may say he needs another scoop of ice cream, but really he just wants one. He will survive without it, even if he thinks he won't. In Maslow's pyramid, the remaining needs, the extra scoops of ice cream, are love, a sense of belonging, and being esteemed. Self-actualization, that is, reaching one's full potential, is the cherry on top. Ask people what they need to survive, and there is a very strong probability that they will produce answers from the bottom tiers of the pyramid, like food, water, and shelter. Infants need food, water, and shelter too. The difference is that infants have no way of getting these things for themselves. They're absolutely useless when it comes to surviving on their own. What all mammalian infants, from tree shrews to human babies, really need from the moment of birth is a caregiver who is committed to making sure that the infant's biological needs are met. If this is true, then Maslow had it wrong. To get it right, we have to move social needs to the bottom of his pyramid. Food, water, and shelter are not the most basic needs for an infant. Instead, being socially connected and cared for is paramount. Without social support, infants will never survive to become adults who can provide for themselves. Being socially connected is a need with a capital N. This restructuring of Maslow's pyramid tells us something critical about who we are. Love and belonging might seem like a convenience we can live without, but our biology is built to thirst for connection because it is linked to our most basic survival needs. As we will see, connection is the first of three adaptations that support our sophisticated sociality, but our need for connection is the bedrock upon which the others are built. Physical injury leads to bodily pain, which motivates us to find shelter and rest so that our body can heal itself. If our social needs really are basic survival needs with a capital N, then unmet social needs should be experienced as a pain with a capital P, too. This sentiment was expressed by noted neuroscientist Paul MacLean, who wrote, "A sense of separation is a condition that makes being a mammal so painful. Is there a link between the pain of physical harm and the pain of social harm? Is social pain real? Pain may not be all in your mind, but it is a lot more in your mind than most people realize. I don't mean to suggest that the psychological aspects are somehow done away with. I am not a reductionist. Rather, in daily life, we tend to create an artificial separation between things like pain and emotion. Pain, emotion, and all that we experience are necessarily simultaneous expressions of psychological and physical processes. Starting from this view, it is not beyond the realm of possibility that something as seemingly as abstract as social pain could be just as tangible and just as painful from the brain's perspective as physical pain. I do not mean to suggest that physical and social pain are identical. No one has ever broken his arm and confused that with having been dumped by his girlfriend. And memories of social pain are much more intense than memories of physical pain. Different kinds of pain feel differently and have distinctive characteristics. What I am suggesting is that social pain is real pain, just as physical pain is real pain. Understanding this has important consequences for how we think about the social distress that we and those around us experience. Since then, non-sedating levels of opiates have been shown to reduce separation distress cries in a variety of mammalian species. Moreover, reconnection between mother and infant increases opiate levels naturally in both parties. This suggests that the same neurochemical that is instrumental in alleviating the distress of physical pain may also be central in alleviating the distress of social separation in infants. This was the first hard evidence that social and physical pain are treated in similar ways by the brain. First, the ACC is one of the neural adaptations that distinguishes mammals from our reptilian ancestors. We have cingulates, and reptiles do not. It makes sense to expect that new psychological processes first emerging in mammals, like attachment and social pain, might be linked to new mammalian brain structures like the ACC. Second, the ACC has the highest density of opioid receptors of any region in the brain. So it makes sense that physical and social pain may well be linked to this specific region. Third, it has been shown that the DACC plays an instrumental role in the experience of physical pain. Last, the DACC has been linked to mother-infant attachment behavior in various non-human mammals. We spent the better part of the next year analyzing the data, but there was a single moment when we knew we might be on to something interesting. Looking at the screen side by side, without knowing which was an analysis of physical pain and which was an analysis of social pain, you wouldn't have been able to tell the difference. These findings highlighted one of the things fMRI research can do to help us understand the human mind in general. It can illuminate when two mental processes that seem different actually rely on common neural mechanisms, suggesting they are more psychologically intertwined than we would have guessed. Here, the mammalian need to recognize social threats appears to have hijacked the physical pain system to do what the pain system always does: remind us when there is a threat to one of our basic needs.
So that is the first segment. So I'll just be kind of lays out some of the topics he kind of covers a little more in detail later on, but on the connection of the pain center in the brain and social interactions, which is very interesting, something that I talked about a little bit earlier with the rat park experiment, but it's something really fascinating. Basically, the same area of the brain that causes you pain, the same area that kind of causes a affects your social interactions. And a little snippet from Daniel Dennett, may he rest in peace. He just passed away this year. I would consider one of our generation's or this era's philosophers. It covers a lot about consciousness, comedy. That little clip is talking about the origins of the comedy. I thought as a cool little snippet. I am a proponent of his theory on comedy. It's basically it's a social construct where people are. It's an error correction device. And basically, comedy is like figuring out where right and wrong kind of lives on that that line. That's why often comedy can be considered offensive by some people and not offensive by other people. But it's meant to be kind of pushing up against the boundaries of what we find either socially acceptable or a wacky idea. So it's a really fascinating idea. He's, I would say, one of the leading minds on consciousness, which I'll cover at some point. We only got a half an hour left, guys, gals, everyone out there in the snow. Hopefully I can get back home in the snow. So we'll move on to we'll play a little song, just kind of break it up a little bit, and we'll move on to a second part of the clips that I set aside for this book.
Scoop of salted caramel ice cream, you would undoubtedly find increased activity throughout my brain's reward system. Or you could save a lot of money on fMRI scans and just ask me if I love salted caramel ice cream. When it comes to ice cream, our conscious experiences and our brains tell the same story. So why isn't it the same with social rewards? Why doesn't it seem like being treated fairly would feel good? Why don't we recognize that there is something intrinsically rewarding about helping others that does not depend on believing one will benefit materially? Research suggests the reason is that we feel compelled to tell everyone how selfish we are, even if we aren't selfish. I was recently at a meeting of the social psychologists in my department, professors and graduate students. The area chair made a point of thanking Kelly Gildersleeve, a graduate student who had spent a lot of time over the summer streamlining a bureaucratic process by moving it to the internet. When everyone in the room heartily applauded her effort, Kelly blushed and blurted out that she was going to benefit from the streamlining as well, so she would be getting something out of it. It was a complete lie. The time she put in will never be offset by the savings she will get in her last year of graduate school. Kelly told me later that even as she heard herself saying this, she knew it wasn't true. But she said those selfish-sounding words anyway. Kelly helped because she is a kind and thoughtful person who saw a problem and knew she could help. Kelly helped because it is intrinsically rewarding to help those around you. For some reason, though, when someone asks us why we help, we often find ourselves saying things that makes us sound more selfish than we are. Dale Miller, a social psychologist at Stanford University, has identified the root cause of this faux selfish behavior. The theorizing of Hobbes, Hume, and other intellectuals, who claim that self-interest is the source of all human motivation, has produced a self-fulfilling prophecy. Their theory, and everyone who repeats it, have affected how the rest of society behaves. Because we have been taught that people are self-interested, we conform to this cultural norm to avoid standing out. Miller has shown in multiple experiments that we assume others are far more self-interested than they really are. In one study, he asked individuals what percentage of undergraduates they thought would agree to give blood for $15 and what percentage would agree to give blood if there were no financial incentive. Respondents estimated half as many people would give blood for free as would for the money, 32 versus 62%. But in measuring actual volunteer rates, he found that those who were offered no money agreed to give blood 62% of the time, only slightly less often than those who were paid, 73%. Because of these mistaken assumptions about everyone else's selfishness, we tend to avoid appearing altruistic ourselves. We don't want to appear to be boasting or come off as a goody-two-shoes. If you believe that people in general don't think altruism exists, then claiming your own actions are altruistically motivated feels like putting yourself on a pedestal. For this reason, when people are asked why they have engaged in pro-social behaviors, they tend to ascribe their actions to self-interest. I volunteer because I'm bored, and it gives me something to do. When we regularly hear other people giving selfish-sounding reasons for their altruistic behavior, it only serves to bolster our belief that all behavior is self-interested, which in turn makes us less likely to admit our own altruistic motives. The cycle is self-reinforcing, becoming more and more ingrained over time. The irony of this was brought home in another of Miller's studies. People were approached to donate to a charity. People who were asked to simply donate found it hard to generate a self-interested explanation for helping the charity. Other people were informed that they would receive a small candle in return for their donation. The candle created an exchange fiction, allowing people to say, "I didn't donate to help. I was buying a candle." As expected, people were more likely to donate when they would get a candle in return compared to when no candle was offered. They also donated much more money under these conditions. Ironically, getting a trinket in return allows us to cover our generosity with a non-altruistic account and thus frees us to act more altruistically. Alexis de Tocqueville, the French scholar who wrote the first great book about the United States, Democracy in America, in 1835, noted his surprise when it came to Americans' thoughts about their own good deeds. "The Americans are fond of explaining almost all the actions of their lives by the principle of self-interest. In this respect, I think they frequently fail to do themselves justice. In the United States, as well as elsewhere, people are sometimes seen to give way to those disinterested, that is, not self-interested, and spontaneous impulses that are natural to man. But the Americans seldom admit that they yield to emotions of this kind. The fact is, we are full of both selfish and unselfish motives. And this is no accident. Mammalian brains are wired to care for others. And among primates, this caring extends to at least some non-kin, even when there is no material return on the investment. Because of the way our brains are wired, Eating a delicious piece of cake is enjoyable whether we are hungry or not. Similarly, helping others feels good whether we expect something in return or not. Just imagine what things would look like if we were taught about this in school and we understood that altruistic helping is just as natural as being selfish. The strange stigma associated with altruistic behavior would be lifted, perhaps engendering far more pro-social behavior. Me in.
So just to talk about that a little bit, it's a very another. When I was reading this book, my mind was blown like 1,000 times. Just throwing it out there. But basically, he's talking about how our individual nature is kind of is a forced narrative, or even a thing that's really. Since enlightenment happened a long time ago, it's kind of been a thing that expected that you, and a lot of modern, even though a lot of economic theories have kind of pushed against this of recent, that humans are selfish individuals, they're self-interested, and they're rational beings. And most of the studies in social science has kind of pushed against that theory a bit. And saying we're more balanced individuals. We're really a social animal. That altruism is not something that goes against our nature. It is part of our nature. In general, it's how it affects our own social group. If we feel like if it's a net positive in our minds, that has a positive effect on our social groups, something we will take a loss for ourselves to help a social group. And this kind of goes against the theory of being like, why do people vote against their self-interest? You've probably heard that a million times. And it's mainly to do with the theory in sociology is that people are a social animal. If they're in their community, if their community believes that this item is something that's important, if they value that the theory of someone is self-interested and someone that's not self-interested is seen as someone that's outside the norm. This also ties in with another author that talks about weird, how our society is a weird society, Western, educated, industrial, rich, and democratic. And this is a new phenomenon in societies that are outside the quote-unquote weird acronym, are more altruistic, have different they see things differently than our societies do. So, and I have a bunch of content about enlightenment and how it changed things for good and bad and feudalism and a bunch of other stuff like that. But, let's get back into the third part of this segment that I put together and see what else he has to say. I just want to call on the mic and talk about that and give a little more detail because I just found that fascinating. So hopefully you guys do too. Anyway, back to the content.
In the mirror, Descartes' belief, mind and body, was a profound error about the way nature works, but it was an accurate assessment of how our brains represent the world. Hundreds of years before the neural data was discovered, Descartes recognized that there is a deep division in these two components of how we see ourself, body and mind. Does this mean we have two selves? If so, which self do we recognize when we see our reflection? Once fMRI became popular decades later, scientists examined self-recognition in the scanner to determine its neural bases. Across more than a dozen studies, a clear pattern has emerged. When people see and recognize a picture of themselves, in contrast to pictures of friends, celebrities, or strangers, regions in the right prefrontal and parietal cortex on the lateral surface of the brain are more active. In addition, the parietal region that responds to seeing one's own face also responds to keeping track of one's own body movements. Neural dualists. For 40 years, we have taken mere self-recognition as a decisive sign of self-awareness in others. But the truth is more complicated. In Cartesian terms, this test focuses on the recognition of our body as our body. In Descartes' meditation, it was the irreducibility of our minds that led to his famous maxim, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. When we urge people to know themselves, are we talking about the same kind of knowing that lets us know it's us in the mirror? Mere self-recognition is a kind of self-awareness, but is it really representative of the deep kind of self-knowledge that we seek? Bill Kelly, Todd Heatherton, and Neil McRae, prominent social neuroscientists from Dartmouth College, ran a simple but elegant experiment that answered this question conclusively. In an fMRI study, participants were shown adjectives such as polite and talkative. For some of the trials, participants had to judge whether the adjective described George W. Bush, who was the U.S. president at the time. On other trials, participants had to judge whether the adjectives described themselves. The critical analysis examined whether there were any regions of the brain that were more active when people judged the applicability of an adjective to themselves as opposed to George Bush. There were only two regions of the brain whose activity followed this pattern. Just as in the mirror self-recognition studies, there was activity in the prefrontal cortex and parietal cortex. But unlike the mirror self-recognition studies, these activations were present in the medial prefrontal cortex, MPFC, and the precuneus, on the midline of the brain where the two hemispheres meet, rather than on the lateral surface of the brain near the skull. In other words, recognizing yourself in the mirror and thinking about yourself conceptually rely on very different neural circuits. Seeing yourself and knowing yourself are two different things. There are at least two major implications of this distinction between self-seeing and self-knowing. First, this distinction clarifies what the mere self-recognition test tells us about the animals that can pass it. Chimps, dolphins, and elephants all have some sense of their corporeal identity, that the body they see in the mirror is their body. However, the fMRI data suggests that passing this test does not imply that these animals engage in self-reflection the same way that we do, reflecting on whether we possess a particular personality trait or wondering what will become of us in 10 years. It does not imply that these animals reflect on the wisdom of their past decisions. And it certainly does not imply that these animals come to have a conceptual sense of self through introspective contemplation. Second, the neural separation of representing our own bodies and representing our own minds explains why we can't get away from Descartes' mind-body dualism. All signs point toward mind-body dualism being a bad explanation of what we are, and yet most of us operate like card-carrying dualists. We can't help it, because it is literally wired into our operating system to see the world in terms of minds and bodies that are separated from one another. We have one system for thinking about our own minds and another one for recognizing our own bodies. And these systems are separated in the brain. It is not that minds and bodies are separate realms in reality, but the ways we register them are separated in our brains, and there isn't much we can do to bridge this neural chasm. Just as colors and numbers are experienced as radically different because they depend on disassociated systems in the brain, our mind and body are forever cleaved from one another. Trojan Man. The Trojan horse was not at all what it seemed. Instead of being the spoils of war, it was a cleverly disguised deception that allowed the Greeks entry into Troy and led to its being overtaken by the Greeks. In the same vein, I would argue that we can describe our sense of self as a Trojan horse self. In the West, we like to think of the self as that which makes us special, providing us with a unique destiny to reach our personal goals and achieve self-fulfillment. We imagine the self, our sense of who we are, to be a hermetically sealed treasure chest, an impenetrable fortress that only we have access to. If this were really the whole story, such a discussion of the self wouldn't have a place in a book on the social brain. But as it turns out, the self may be evolution's sneakiest ploy to ensure the success of group living. I believe the self is, at least in part, a cleverly disguised deception that allows the social world in and allows us to be overtaken by the social world without our even noticing. 19th century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche gave the most cynical view of this Trojan horse self, writing, "Whatever they may think and say about their egoism, the great majority nonetheless do nothing for their ego their whole life long. What they do is done for the phantom of their ego, which has formed itself in the heads of those around them and has been communicated to them." Nietzsche believed that our sense of self was not something inherently internal to us, a true core to our being, that we gained greater access to over the course of our lives. Instead, he argued that our sense of self is typically something constructed primarily by the people in our lives, and that the self is actually a secret agent working for them more than for us. If one believes that the purpose of the self is to help each of us maximize personal rewards and achievement by better knowing who we are, then it would be tragic to discover that our self actually does something very different from what we think it does. Our responses to cultural trends give us some insight into how this process works. When I see a new look in clothes, my first reaction is often, "That looks ridiculous." Yet a few months later, I find that the trend looks and feels right to me. For a dramatic example of this, consider baby colors. Blue for boys and pink for girls just feels right. It may not be PC, but it's right. I can feel it in my gut. Just imagine if some store tried to switch things up and sell pink for boys and blue for girls. That would never catch on, right? Actually, it already did. 100 years ago, the color scheme for babies was the opposite of what it is now. Consider this comment from a trade journal published in 1918. "The generally accepted rule is pink for the boys and blue for the girls." Somehow, between 1918 and now, our visceral reactions have done a full reversal. Did each person reach this conclusion privately? Or was there some process at work to make sure our way of seeing things stayed in line with what we perceive to be the beliefs of those around us? Just like most of our beliefs, this visceral response to baby colors is something we pick up from the outside without even noticing it. Each of us has a variety
of... You're listening to WRUV FM Burlington. Not quite enough time to finish off the next segment, but I'll probably just talk a little bit in general about, so I'll probably be back throughout the semester doing a few other shows. I have a script that I have a friend from the UK said she would help me read, so I might do that. And I'm reaching out to some nonprofit organizations and doing interviews with them. Just basically organizations that are in the community and places where you can volunteer or join a society. That's some of the ideas that I'm putting out there. There's also a bunch of other content that I've broken up into some cohesive ideas that I'm trying to get through or talk about. So probably, I could probably just go through some of the, I talked about weird, I could talk about some of the things that I'm potentially be in some of the later episodes. So one of the things that really kind of brought me to doing this show, I'm a bit of a science nerd. I like science. Physics generally is my go-to. And then there was a show called Connections. It was put out by the BBC, I believe, in the late 60s. It's a great show about the history of science. And its whole gist was, here's this item, here's this invention that caused this invention, that caused this invention, that caused this invention, and this is why we have airplanes. So it's a very unique view on history with a little scientific take and kind of building upon like everything that we use, from computers to even the plastic case CDs come in, are step inventions that came to this. It's not just one person that came up with this. It kind of builds upon the backs of everyone else before them. But in the first episode, there was an interesting thing about the power outage in 1967, I believe, was the year that it happened. And there's an incident where these people on the subway, the power goes out, the subway stops, kind of gets dark. And if you've ever been on the Newark subway, you know, people don't talk to each other. They really don't interact. So it's kind of like, and when the power went out on the subway, spontaneously, people were talking to each other. Someone had a cake and they were like cutting up the cake and having a birthday party and sharing their items. And it's just this weird spot where people kind of became more social. So I was like, well, that's in my mind, that's kind of weird, especially on a New York subway. It's like, why does that happen? So that question kind of led me down this path of kind of dipping my toe into sociology. Also Malcolm Gladwell. I'm pretty sure most of people have heard it, if you know books. He also dips into sociology a lot. So there's kind of been of popular literature, there's been a lot of sociology information out there. So, but the subway thing, so the best handle I can get on it is basically people become more social when an event of a threat. You have examples of like the hurricane, the flood that happened in Vermont, Irene kind of brought people together. There's also a little bit of darkness kind of plays a role, and also kind of breaking that kind of like kind of snap that kind of social norm of talking on the subway when a notable event can kind of break that consciousness that people see or don't see. So I'm big into dance music. That's kind of like the stuff that I played before here on WRUV. And that's kind of interesting. It's also, that ties in with Communitas and how music can bring people together in a social event, and how it can culture social ties, which I always find interesting, on how dance music in particular affects the human brain and our social interactions. So that's kind of like my angle that I'm coming into this whole project. So it's almost 6 o'clock. So next DJ will be up soon. I'm going to play some stuff from a former WRUV DJ called Koshik. Was on Stone Throw for a while. His CD. We're going to let them play out. And the next DJ do what they want to do if they're here. And yeah, so keep on listening to WRUV FM Burlington. Oh, and you can email me with any suggestions, or if you have any community organizations you would like me to interview for this show, you can email me at lyceuminColosseum@protonmail.com. So that's Lyceum in Colosseum, it rhymes, at protonmail.com. And you can reach out to me that way. That's dedicated to this whole thing. So anyway, let's get to the music and keep it real, guys.